know, they couldn't relate to, like, Rob, you know, what Rob found, you know, like, you had to play on the weekends, you know, and plus practicing. And to us, you know, to the other three of us, to me, Fred, and Rob, rock and roll was the most important thing in our lives, you know.
Period.
And Bob and Pat, like, they had other things, you know, like, they had cars and girls and jobs and all that stuff, you know. So they had to finally just reach a point where they had to decide themselves which direction they wanted to go in, and they picked the security of a job and a car and a girlfriend over the daring and the thrills and excitement of the land of rock and roll.
At the Crystal Bar.
At the Crystal Bar, right. So
Mike and Dennis.
Yeah, so eventually they left the band, you know, right. Around 66.
Before the Crystal Bar.
Yeah. One of them left before, and the other one left at the Crystal Bar.
Right.
And that's when we got Dennis in the band, and Michael. Dennis, me and Fred had both played with back in the days of the Bounty Hunters and the Majestics and stuff like that, because he also went to Lincoln Park High, and, you know, we all went to classes together, and he played drums back in the whole downriver rock and roll scene, you know. Mm. So we knew him from then, and he had been going through some changes himself about music and just decided he wanted to play rock and roll, the kind of rock and roll that we wanted to play. And so we got together, and Michael
was a folk singer. Oh, it's true. He was the young Bob Dylan of Detroit. And he was going to school. He was an artist. He didn't look back. And he played around down on the campus, you know, and that's where I met up with him, because at the time when I first got into the band, that's what I did for a living. I went down and got drunk on the campus, you know, at Wayne State University. And that's also where I met up with Jan Sinclair, but that comes a little later. Met up with Michael through numerous shady contacts and this and that, and thought that he might work out as a bass player, you know, and sure enough he did. So he joined the band, I think, shortly before, or right at the time that we were playing at the Crystal Bar.
65.
Yeah, 65. And then Dennis joined up, and that's the MC5 of today.
5 years ago.
But at that time, like I said, I personally had been spending a lot of, this is Rob talking, I had been spending a lot of time down on the campus, you know, getting drunk and running around with the beatniks and things, reading poetry and digging bongo music and John Coltrane and like that.
Bongo music? Yeah,
he was a conga drummer.
Right,
that's true.
He was a bongo player.
I was a bongo player, that's true. I used to play the flute also. But I'd heard of this, I'd walk around down on the campus and run into these people who were like giving away, I think it was called Free Poems Among Friends. And that was my first contact with the Artist Workshop, and I read some of their stuff, and it was very far out. And I'd always been into like reading poetry a little bit, you know, sort of, you know, just digging that whole hip level of things. And it was great, you know. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go to one of the little meetings sometimes, because there was this thing called Artist Workshop, and John Sinclair, the infamous pothead and strange guy that ran the thing. And so I went to one of the meetings one time, and this was when this was already when the band was all together. And get up close to the mic and enunciate and say that I went to one of the Sunday meetings at the Artist Workshop, and for those of you who weren't familiar with it, it was a conglomeration of artists and poets, musicians, painters, sculptors, all kinds of people in the Detroit area. You know, they all got together in this old nasty house on Warren, I believe it was, and did these little happenings every Sunday afternoon. And I went to one and saw John Sinclair read poetry one time. I was very, very much impressed by the fact that he really had it together, and he was so strong, you know. He blew everybody back, you know, demanded money out of everybody, grabbed people by the shirt and things, you know, and said, look, this is the community, you gotta give it up right now, you know. So I had to dig that. So I said, well, okay, cool. One day when we got it together, maybe we'll come down and play for these folks, because they're pretty far out, you know. So that was my first actual contact with John Sinclair.
That was before John went to jail.
Right, that was before he went to jail the first time.
What did you do? Did you come back and tell these dudes about John and the artist workshop?
Well, no. I just kept my mouth shut and just figured, well, we'll just develop and see what happens, you know, because what we were doing was pretty interesting. Because, see, about this time, right after the Crystal Bar, 65, thereabouts, our music started to go through some changes, you know, because, like, we were playing in the bar and just generally frustrated with living in Lincoln Park and being part of the whole down trip that goes on, you know. I mean, we were young guys and wanted to express ourselves some way, and the music started getting hairier and stranger, you know, and louder and weirder, and we got some large equipment through one of our previous managers before Swingin' Sweeney and Ann Marsden, a dude named Bruce Burnish. He got us some enormous English Vox equipment, and that helped us get really strange because we could play louder than anybody anywhere, you know.
We had the biggest amps of anybody in Detroit.
Right, long time ago.
We were the first band in Detroit to have Super Beatles.
Right. Yep. And a Vox PA, you know. We had a real PA when everybody else was singing through their amps and stuff. It was great.
Yep.
We were set up.
And like I say, you know, at that point, we were experiencing difficulties when we'd play. Because we'd go in and we'd play songs and the people would dance, you know, just regular rock and roll songs and stuff. But then toward the end of the evening, we'd start to get crazy, you know. And we had this little ditty that we used to do called Black to Calm. You know, Black to Calm's an old, old song. I think it's probably the first song we ever wrote, right?
It's pretty old.
It's an old, old song. And we'd do that, man, and immediately clear the joint. People would just stick their fingers in their ears and run, man.
Gone.
You know, we'd just start. Three people standing out there, and they're all guitar players. You know, watching us. What are these guys doing? You know. So, like, we started to establish a bad reputation. We started to. People started to say that we were weird. And don't hire these guys because they're too unreal, and they play too loud, and it's too strange, and you can't dance to it, and it isn't Louie Louie.
Well, where'd the influence for Black to Calm come from?
Our own frustration, man. You know, it was just latent exhibitionism and frustration that just brought it to the surface and we exploded, you know.
You're just snotty kids, you know.
Right. Yeah. Rock and roll punks from downriver, you know.
And we could play louder than anybody and we could play weirder than anybody.
And we were proud of it. We still are. So anyway, then the specter of the beatniks downtown began to rise its ugly head again, because we figured that, okay, so the kids out in the suburbs can't relate to this trash. And these people are far out. They ought to be able to dig it. So consequently, we invaded Detroit. We began living down there, living in the Wayne campus area and in the nefarious Warren Forest area, I think it's called, and getting in tight with all the people that live down there around the campus. And we played a hippie, a proto-hippie wedding reception, pre-hippie, and played our crazy music, and the people liked it. They just went crazy and started to dance all freakish and everything, and we really dug it. John was away at jail for the first time. He'd been away for 6 months, and they had a big festival for him when he came back. It was the Artist Workshop Festival of People, and it was a whole day-long extravaganza of painting exhibits and poetry readings and dancing, modern dance,
theater,
theater,
jazz groups.
Right. Incredible jazz music. And the last thing on the show, actually, at like, what, 4 in the morning or something like that, we waited around all day to play because we got so excited,
chance, right? To get the hippies, you know? We figured if we get these weirdos to like us, we knew that someday the weird, being weird would be in. We'd see some right now.
So we waited around all day, and finally, after a long day's wait, we got to play, and we did 3 songs. We did Black
You Really
to
Come,
You Really Got Me, and what was it?
I'm a Man?
No.
I'm Mad Again?
No, I think it was the weird one we had. Was it Freak Out?
No, not that one.
We hadn't wrote that one yet.
No, that was after.
It might have been...
What could it have been? Doesn't matter.
Anyway.
We did these 3 songs, and right in the middle of Black to Come, Lenny Sinclair came down and pulled the plug on us because we were too loud and we were getting... the cops were coming in.
Fresh out of jail and even run in trouble.
Shortly after that, I was reading in the Fifth Estate one day, and John's column, The Coat Puller, he said something about these blasted rock and roll bands, if they just open up their ears and listen to some black music, you know, then they'd know what's happening. So I got very indignant and wrote this letter back to him that said,
Look here, Jack. There are some rock and roll bands who are opening up their ears and listening to black music, man. And it's just unfortunate that some people, won't open up their ears and listen to rock and roll. So he wrote another letter back, and we established a dialogue, and that's how we got actual personal contact with Jack.
Rob was our first manager, but then he got taken into the band.
I got sucked into the morass.
And then after that, our second manager was probably Bruce Burnish, who was the guy that signed for all our equipment and all that. Drove us around to record hops and bought us big boys.
A good man, Bruce. A good man.
Great man.
A good man.
Great dude.
A good man.
And then after that, it was Swingin' Sweeney and Ann Marsden. Swingin' Sweeney used to be on the radio. Used to be a DJ on the radio, and Ann used to be a Miss America or something like that, Miss Michigan, and an archery champ. And then after that, we didn't have a manager for a long time. Yeah, right. For a long time, we didn't have a manager, and then we met.
Jerry Goodwin used to do a lot of.
Used to help us.
He advised us. Man. He was advised,
but he wasn't really a manager. We wanted him to be our manager, but
so bad.
He was too deep into his whole thing, you know. And then we got hooked up with these guys.
The famous trio.
Right, Arnold Geller, Cliff Goroff, and Larry Benjamin.
Infamously,
and they were since flipped right off.
Yeah,
off the plane at all.
They're going to be our managers and. Record company and record producers.
Everything.
Promoters.
And promoters.
That was it.
And then after that didn't work out, of course.
They did this one.
And then after that, John Sinclair was our manager.
Jerry used to do some stuff for us, too.
Yeah, but he worked through John.
No, before John.
Oh, yeah, back then.
Fraternity parties and stuff.
He was our booking agent and advisor.
And then after John was D'Anthony, who's our manager now. That brings us up to date on the managers.
Larry Benjamin helped produce this I Can Only Give You Everything and One of the Guys, right?
Sort of.
Well, he didn't help produce I Can Only Give You Everything. That was from a previous marriage, but One of the Guys, he helped do that.
What was the deal on that first?
We did that all by ourselves, man.
What's I Can Only Give You Everything?
Yeah.
We did that by ourselves.
That's right, we did it.
Went in there and did it in 1 hour.
You had to be in a band. Like the most, you know, like a big part of it, or the most important thing at that time was to make a record. Somehow, some way, the gods will that it's going to be a hit, you know?
Jerry ever come to KNR to see Paul Cannon about your record?
Yeah, we talked to Paul.
Yeah, but that was too big time.
Never went very far. Paul, was... we got to get out of here. I got no time for you guys.
Did you guys bring the sandwiches?
No.
Well, get out.
You had met John. What kind of change did your music go through after meeting John? I'm sure there was an effect.
It wasn't.
No,
it wasn't really that much.
Kept on doing what
we just kept
on
doing what we were doing, getting louder and crazier. Yeah.
John's influence, I believe, showed up, you know, but it wasn't like a change. You know, John, when he was our manager, he wasn't trying to make us into anything else. He liked us for what we were, and we liked him for what he was, and it was more like just bringing the two together to work together, you know, instead of him trying to change us or us trying to change him or anything like that.
Did you find that the atmosphere which you lived in at that time helped you become looser?
The atmosphere we lived in at that time was just crummy.
It's skunkle.
I mean, that was, at the time, Rob had an apartment on Canfield, and me and Fred and Michael had all kinds of different places all over the Wayne State area, you know, just crummy $5 and
$10. Some of you girls might remember,
Some of you ladies that visited us at those times might remember the terrible conditions. Various bugs and... So, you know, it was really hard. You know, we weren't making no money, and it was hard to keep your mind on what you're trying to do, you know.
Self-respect.
You ain't got, no self-respect.
Right? Didn't have much of a front going then.
Oh, no. No front. Lots in behind, though.
Lots of rap, but no front.
Was any of the MC5 going to college before or during your association with John Sinclair?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was just saying yes.
Oh, yes. Dennis and Mike both went to college.
Mike was studying art.
Dennis was going to be the master mathematician.
He was going to discover
antimatter.
That's right.
That was his thing.
His
he was
going
to go to college and he was going to figure out the secret to antimatter.
And he could have done it too.
Sure.
Well, he's an incredible mathematician. Just incredible.
A computer.
He can tell you 6 times 8 just like that.
Is that right?
So fast.
And I can't.
Fred, can you?
Fred's a high school drunk. He's sharp, but he's a high school drunk.
The official educations of the group range from 3.5 years of fine arts in college to high school dropouts.
You got it all covered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All levels.
That's right. That's
right. Goes to show that anybody can do it.
Well, did somebody volunteer to go to college to find out what it was like, or did you just go on your own?
No.
No.
It was like a family type thing, Mike
it was
to
nothing else.
To study art. He was going to be Michelangelo.
Actually a famous artist.
That's true.
In some of the lower level.
Well, you can't ask them, dear boy.
But he's done some great
he really has.
Paintings and things.
If you've ever seen some of his work.
He's got a
maybe someday
feeling.
Something will happen to it. Maybe someday, you know.
After he dies, he'll be famous.
Right. He's incredible. I mean, you should see the things he does. They're just, they're great.
What did John do for you that other managers hadn't or wouldn't do?
He just was willing to really bust his butt, you know, because he knew that everybody in the music business hated us, you know, and all the local club owners hated us because we were played so loud and you know,
he could relate to us. It was like personal. Usually a relationship with the manager isn't that personal, but with John it was like having your buddy being your manager, which in a lot of ways is nice, you know, very pleasant.
Sure.
And he really got out there and, you know, turned the tide, you know. He's the one that really got out and hustled for us, you know, and got us the jobs and convinced all the club owners that we weren't really monsters, you know.
Well, the Grandy must have been open at this time.
66, October 6th.
And you were the house band at the Grandy Ballroom. How did you meet Uncle Weird?
Well, Uncle Weird came down to the artist workshop where we were practicing one day. Because he was
through Jerry Goodwin, actually.
Jerry Goodwin, right.
Through Jerry Goodwin. Jerry said, look, boys, I know this guy who's going to put together this little thing, you know.
Well, you ought to tell him the story about Russ, though. Russ had went out to California, I guess, and the Fillmore was open out there, and he immediately, his mind went to work, click, 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 and he thought, you know, I could put one of these things together in Detroit, I bet, you know. But he didn't know who to contact in Detroit, you know, the artists, the musicians, and whatever. He didn't know any of those people, you know. So he called up Jerry Goodwin here at K&R and asked Jerry, you know, to turn him on to a good band that might fit into that kind of thing, you know, and Jerry called us.
Because there weren't but one band in the city that was doing that kind of thing, you know.
It was perfect. You know, Jerry called us up, and so, you know, we were hip to that idea anyway, and we thought it was perfect, you know. And it turned out pretty good, you know. Unfortunately, there's small drawbacks here and there, but, you know, the idea of having a ballroom in the town really sounded great to us.
We flipped out because it was right in line with what we knew had to happen, you know. Plus, we could make $125 a job. Can you imagine? You know what that means? Food.
That was $25 a piece, boy.
That's what we used to do.
Everything.
$125, split it up 5 ways.
That was it.
That's it.
Well, how did you meet Russ? What was your first confrontation with Uncle Russ?
Well, he came down to audition us. We were playing at the artist workshop. You know, we were rehearsing there one day, and he came down and he said, "Well, okay, cool. I want to open up this little place, and look here. What kind of stuff do you guys into? You know, you play any like freaky stuff?" And we said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, you came to the right place, man. Look out. Here it comes." So we played him some freaky stuff. And he said, stood there with his hands over his ears for a while. And he said, "Well, do you play any, like, straighter kind of stuff? You know, I mean, like, you know, regular." I said, "Oh, yeah, we can play that, too." So we played him a regular song, and he liked it. So
played him Louie Louie.
Right.
Louie Louie, sure.
Right? So he says, "Yeah, yeah, okay, cool. Well, So then we started getting deep into it. He said, "Well, what do you think about lights and stuff? You know, what do you think about this and that? You know."
He didn't have any ideas, you know.
He didn't know.
He just know he wanted to do something, you know.
So like me and Gary Grimshaw went down to the ballroom and built the first light stand that there ever was in the Grandy Ballroom. You know, ourselves, me and him, with hammers and nails and stuff, you know.
And like, and we got Rob's the one that started calling him Uncle Russ.
Right.
That's right. That's true.
Hi, Russ.
Robin Tyner.
What did the Grandy look like when you first went down there?
Oh, it was horrifying, man. Horrifying. There was ghosts and things, and it was terrible.
Skunky, dirty,
yeah. Terrible. Crummy.
Worms under the
rug. Since it was Soul City. No, they had Soul City dancing.
Right. Ernie Durham. He's a down dude. He used to run.
I used to listen to Ernie all the time.
Me too.
We met him a few weeks ago. He's doing great.
Oh, he's incredible, man.
He is.
What a voice, man.
Electric shock just listening to him.
Still doing great, man. He rolls right on.
He just jives right down. No chance you're going to get by it.
Yep. Oh, definitely not. The man's fast. There's nothing else. There's nothing else you can say. But, like, you know, we were deep into it, you know. We wanted to see this thing really come off. We wanted to see it really be nice, you know. We wanted to have it like a real whole total environment, you know. And like we used to use the entire thing when we'd play, you know. We'd have all the lights go off and then have the strobes on 100%, you know, and like totally deorient everybody while we're playing weird stuff, you know. And like we just got generally into it, you know. Tried to utilize the whole thing as much as we could. And, of course, it's gone through a lot of changes.
It certainly has. You've closed the ballroom, what, 5 or 6 times now?
Many times. Closed it and opened it.
It's always good for a couple extra dollars. You know if they're ever going to open, yet you're going to play, they're going to have a gig. What about when you did your tunes, you must have had 5 guys all probably had certain ideas about the music. What kind of problems did you have getting it together as far as writing tunes or performing what you did for
it all? Black eyes, broken legs. There were problems, you know. Spent a few days in the hospital. You couldn't work and stuff. Wasn't
screaming, hollering,
carrying on,
fisticuffs.
All the usual stuff.
Basically, what we wanted to do was play music that had what we call drive. You know, like Chuck Berry music has drive. You know, and that was the basic feature of what we wanted to do. We wanted to have music that just rolled along. You know, just moved, did something. And like any other problems were like they're like secondary to that, because that had to be there. That drive had to be there.
My favorite MC5 tune is Looking At You, and I believe you wrote that here in Detroit in a bar, didn't you?
Yeah, at the Crystal Bar. Yeah.
At the Crystal Bar.
Yep, live on stage.
Is it intact as it was written?
No.
No. Well, it used to be really slow. We used to do it really slow.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 like that.
Your live version of it now is incredible.
Incredible. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome, friend.
Splice. The police state, it smells bad, you can't breathe, you can't hear, it's terrible.
Yeah, it was just, you know, it's so dirty and uptight and dangerous and crummy, you know.
Raucous.
Did Ann Arbor have any effect upon you?
Well, sure. You know, trying to change your environment is going to have an effect on you.
Let's have some of that effect.
Right, we're stalling for time here, folks.
Well, I don't know, you know, where it came out, it was just, you know, nicer.
It's a different feeling up there, you know.
You could go for a walk at night.
And lay in your backyard and relax if you wanted, you know.
You could go out in the front and play frisbee and everything would be cool, you know.
You could go for a walk at night. That's an incredible statement. It's very true.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the cops used to come by and shine their lights in the windows and stuff. But outside of that, you know, I mean, it wasn't the actual, you know, physical contact with the police like in Detroit. You know, you could just...
Yeah, in Detroit, they'd be beating our door down every other day looking for runaways and, you know...
and finding them.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all these, you know, crazed speed freaks and junkies coming over all the time, you know.
Ripping off everything.
Stealing everything. Crazed. It was maddening. We had 9 guitars stolen in...
2 weeks.
2 weeks at one point.
What?
9 guitars, man.
And we weren't making any money at that time.
Yeah, we had shut us down for a month.
Debt. As a matter of fact, that's when we went in debt. We've been in debt ever since.
Do the MC5, or did the MC5, have any other activities besides rock and roll?
Have what? Any other activities?
Besides rock and roll.
I used to read a lot.
You know, and Dennis was a tri-state tennis champ, and...
I played baseball when I was 13.
Is that what you mean? What did you mean? Do we have part-time jobs or something?
Well, if you did, where were they at? It'd be interesting to find.
We didn't have any.
Didn't have
rock
any.
And roll, man.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get. When do you? When did you feel that the upsurge in your popularity began?
When we made our first album.
You don't think before that?
You know.
No, that was the thing. That
no, I think before that there was...
Well, it was like a local feeling,
sure,
you know.
It was a local scene, you know, but it was very, it was real nice, you know.
It felt great.
It was great times at the Grandy, you know, before we ever had an album.
You know? Well, it was like, you know, every musician looks for recognition, you know, I mean, whatever level you get it at, you know. And like, we felt great, man, when people started to dig us and come to see us and everything. We felt great.
But it really broke loose when we made our record.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
What was the... there's a little story about a confrontation between a dude named Jack Bruce who wandered off the wrong side of the stage.
Yes. I happened to have been there at the time.
Let's hear that story.
It's a story I'll take with me to my grave.
I think Fred was the...
Fred was the assailant.
Fred, let's hear about that one.
Well, I cornered him in the dressing room. And I just asked him what the deal was with the cream, you know, and to find out. I didn't dig the cream myself, see? And he was very defensive about it, backed him against the wall. There were all these Detroit guys standing around, you know, and Jack Bruce is like 5'6" or something.
Right, all these big Detroit guys.
You know, I was asking him, you know, why does he do this and why does he do that?
And so Smith
is from England. I don't know too much about old school. I've got to get up on stage. I can't.
But the classic.
What about this and that?
The classic thing of all time was that Smith is standing there, right, with his guitar on, and he backed Bruce up against the wall, you know, and put his finger in his chest and he says, "You know, Jack, you need another guitar player in your band." One guitar does not make it.
He was, this was between the drum solo, right, that he had walked
on? Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
I wasn't there at the time.
You weren't there?
He was really very defensive about it, you know. I just wanted to talk to him, but I guess
he was scared stiff.
He was just afraid, you know. He didn't know what we were going to do.
He told Uncle Russell you were rather insolent, didn't he?
I know.
Yeah, yeah, an insolent
the word,
band.
Right, that's the word that he used. One of the MC5 was insolent to me.
Was there any point at which you felt that you should not do what you were doing? Like when you were with John in the early days, say 2 years ago, and you saw that you were changing your musical and political taste, was there any time there that you wish you could stop what was happening?
No, I don't think there was any time when we just said, well, God, this is all terrible and we have to stop. And we never even thought about it.